Appreciate Jacob reading that passage of Scripture for us, and that's our text for today, Romans chapter 13. So I encourage you to have your New Testament open to that place, and the lesson will come from there. We'll look at other passages as well, but that's the key text. It is a text that reminds us about the importance of the factor of time in our lives in so many ways. We sometimes ask the question, do you know what time it is? And that can be a question that we ask because we ourselves don't know when we're hoping for help. It can also be a rhetorical question that simply has implications because you're late. You know, we live in a world that is captured in time and is governed by time, and that ends up meaning that so much of our lives are wrapped up with time. It's become a way of life for most of us. We watch our clocks. We write in our daily planners. We use our computers and our smartphones and all of these other electronic devices and gadgets to remind us about our appointments, to remind us of the time. It just seems like we are obsessed with it sometimes. So many things in life have become urgent to us. Someone once said that we have become so focused on the urgent that we have lost sight of the important. Well, there's a lot of truth to that. And part of the problem is that our definition of what is urgent doesn't always conform to the Lord's definition of what is urgent. The same is true of what we consider to be important. Well, there's so many ways that we can illustrate this in our lives. When I was, for all the years that I was in school, this started when I was in high school, I guess, and I don't know when it started, but I would have these dreams, and my dream, I'd wake up just so glad when I woke up that it was only a dream, because I was dreaming that I had shown up at school and there was a test and I had forgotten to prepare for it. And it was just, it seemed like, I don't know if this is a sign of my basic insecurity is what it is, but I had those dreams, and I'd have these dreams long after I was through with school, and that's a long time because I did a lot of school. Long after that, I'd still have that dream, wake up having a nightmare about showing up and being unprepared for a test or a paper was due or whatever it might be. Time went by, and the subject matter changed, but it was the same old song, different verse, and I had these dreams where I would show up at church, and it was time for the preacher to get up, and then I suddenly realized and remembered, oh, that's me. And I had not prepared. And the time had gone by, and I had nothing prepared to say. And so I'm sitting there through the final song. I mean, my dreams got real detailed sometimes. We're singing through this last song, and I'm hoping that the song will be all four or five verses so I can think of something I'm going to say. You know, the urgency of life. And you know, we have these things that happen to us, and you know, when it is time to take the exam at school, then so much of it is based on time, and I always worried about when the teacher was finally going to say those words, your time is up, put down your pencil. Will I have enough time to complete the exam? You know, in sports it's that way, particularly in basketball and football. Now, baseball, you know, that could go on, I guess, indefinitely. They have been known to postpone games and come back the next day to resume because, you know, it's not, like the fella said, it's not over till it's over in baseball. But you know, in these other sports, there's a time clock. And one of the most fascinating things is to see how well or how poorly the coach uses the clock. Yeah, when it's down to crunch time and the score is still close, it's still mathematically, theoretically possible for either team to win, and they use their timeouts, they use the time. You know, what's fascinating to me is they have a time clock, but you can stop the clock. Isn't that an interesting concept? There have been a lot of times in my life, like when I'm taking one of those exams, that I wish I could just stop the clock. Put it on hold. We can't do that, can we, in real life? Maybe that's enough illustrations of that principle. The reality is that the truly important things in life have a sense of urgency about them. Paul, in this passage here in Romans chapter 13, wants to remind the Christians to have regard for the time. He says, knowing the time, that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. For now, salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. The book of Romans doesn't deal a great deal with end time events. It doesn't deal a great deal with what we sometimes call eschatology. That means the end times, the study of the last days. It doesn't deal a whole lot with, at least explicitly, with the second coming of Jesus or the final judgment and our eternal home in heaven. Now, other places, Paul does deal with that. If you read 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians, Paul is dealing with that. It's right up front and center. He's dealing with those matters because that's the topic that he is really focusing on. Does do it a whole lot here. It's more implicit. But this passage is clearly about that. This passage is about the end times. And it is a reminder to us that we are in the last days. Now, some people have made the mistake in reading passages like this where he talks about how, the time is near, salvation is near, those kind of things. Other passages talk about the day being near. And so it has led some people to theorize that early Christians in the days of Paul believed that Christ's second coming was very close, that it was going to come very soon. It was going to come in their lifetime. And so to read this passage through that kind of thinking would result in the conclusion that Paul is really kind of prophesying here that the Lord's second coming is imminent. It's right around the corner. Well, of course, no one knows when Christ will return. Don't we remember what Jesus said about that? He said, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. And if I understand that very direct statement, that excludes the Apostle Paul. And the Apostle Paul was not predicting the time of the second coming of the Lord. Other people have read passages like these in the New Testament and said, well, maybe he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Because we know that Jesus had predicted the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 24, and other parallel passages in the Gospels record that incident. We know that was very soon. It occurred in the year of AD 70, which is just a few years hence. But I would suggest to you that kind of approach is misguided as well. That's my conclusion. I don't believe he's talking about that. Because in reality, to say that it's talking about that temporal judgment, which was surely to come, they certainly were aware of that if they knew of the Lord's prediction. But all temporal judgments like that still have this basic principle and still were prefiguring the ultimate final judgment of God. And so here's what we have, I believe, in passages like this, is that the New Testament teaches us that we are in the last days. We are in the last days. That has prophetic significance because the prophets talked about things that were coming in the last days or the latter days. And on the day of Pentecost, when Peter preached his sermon, he said, said, this is, said, we're not drunk as you might suppose, said, but rather this is that which was spoken of by the prophet Joel, that certain things would happen in the last days. We're in the last days. Well, do we stop and think often enough about what it means to be in the last days? We're in them. What does that mean? When we read our Bibles, we come to recognize that we're in the last days in the sense that we are already participating in something that will finally be consummated and reach its perfection when we're with Him in heaven. This particular perspective is what some have referred to as the concept of already but not yet. Already, but not yet. That is, we are already in the last days. We are already part of that kingdom that was prophesied by the prophets, the kingdom that Jesus came to establish. We're already a part of that. But we are not yet in that kingdom as it will be in its perfection when we're with Him in heaven. That's still something we're waiting for. So what are we doing in the meantime? Well, here in these last days that we're in now is the kind of thing that Paul describes here in these verses where he says, well, the time that we're in now, we're still in a time of darkness. We're in a time of darkness. There's still sin around us. There's still Satan having his way and leading people down the wrong path, and people are making bad choices, and there's sin and there's death. And all of those things that the Lord came to win a victory over, they're still here. So when are we going to see the final outcome of the victory? You see, he says that it's already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. Salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. The night is almost gone. The day is near. I'm looking forward to that time when it's day and there'll be no night. But we're not there yet. So what are we supposed to be doing now? There's an urgency about all this. A very strong and powerful sense of urgency. In fact, I would suggest to you that the fact that Jesus makes it clear that no one knows the time when Christ will return, Paul did not know when that was going to happen, adds even more strength to the principle, the important principle, that while we do not know when He is going to come, we know that He is going to come, and that means that we should live every day as if it was the day. And if that's not urgency, beloved, I don't know what is. Every day should be lived as if we're going to face the Lord, or at least we could. We don't know. When will it be? Will it be another 2,000 years? Will it be just another millennium? Or will it be before this service is concluded? Statements like these in the New Testament should be understood then as reminders that we should live each day with that awareness. Indeed, the moral conditions of the time in which we live should serve as a reminder that each passing hour brings us closer, closer and closer to the final day and to the judgment and to our salvation. Yes, as Paul says, we are closer now to our salvation, our reward in heaven, than when we first obeyed the gospel of Christ. There's a sense of urgency all through the New Testament then. Even in the earthly ministry of Jesus, He sensed that. He said in John chapter 9, verse 4, He said, we must work the works of Him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. Well, of course, Jesus knew that He had a limited amount of time here on this earth to do the Father's work. That awareness and that statement should stand as a symbol of what our attitude ought to be as well. In the closing chapters of Matthew's Gospel, we have a whole series of the parables of Jesus that have this in common. that at that particular point in Jesus' earthly ministry, as he is approaching the hour of his death, he teaches a number of lessons through parables that are talking about the day of the Lord, that are talking about the final judgment and the importance of being prepared and the importance of being alert. So in Matthew chapter 24, verse 42, for example, he says, "Be on the alert, therefore, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming." We don't know, so what should we do? Be alert. Be ready. And what follows then is this series of parables that are based on this sense of urgency of being ready for the coming of the Lord. So you have this parable of the faithful and wise servant in Matthew 24, 45-51. You have the parable of the 10 virgins. 5 were wise and 5 were foolish. You have the parable of the talents. You have the parable of the sheep and the goats, which is a figurative picture of final judgment. All of these are, while they're approaching it from a slightly different point of view, all of them are reminding those people that Jesus taught and reminding us of the importance of being prepared. There's a sense of urgency in it. And in the epistles, we see this often, not just here in Romans. You see in Ephesians chapter 5, there, beginning in verse 11, Paul says, "Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time." That is, redeeming the time. Make the most of the time. Buy up the opportunities. Why? Because the days are evil. Because the days, these last days, we still live in this world. We still are in the flesh. We're still fighting the battles. The struggle is there. So he says, what do we have to do? We have to redeem the time. We have to walk circumspectly, he says in that passage, which is just taken directly from the Greek. In our vernacular, it means you better keep your eyes open all around. It's like walking on a tightrope. You better be sure you know where you're stepping and where you're walking each step of the way, because it's important what we do in our lives. Also with 1 Thessalonians, there's a passage that really talks a lot about the second coming of the Lord. And so in 1 Thessalonians 5, we have words like these. Paul says, "Now as to the times and the epochs," or the times and the seasons, "brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you, for you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night." And then he says, "So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober." So I want to talk to you just a few moments with three applications back here from Romans chapter 13. All three of these are found in this text. Three applications of how knowing the time, this sense, this awareness, this sense that we are in these last days, that it should cause us to recognize the urgency of how we walk in the time that we have. And the first one here is verses 8 through 10. Now, there's kind of a segue taking place here in Paul's letter. 2 weeks ago, we studied from the first 7 verses of Romans chapter 13, his passage about the importance of being in subjection to the governing authorities. We talk about our relationship as Christians to civil government. So he talks about that, and he kind of brings that to a conclusion when he reminds the readers that we have an obligation, therefore, to pay the taxes. You render all that is due to them. You pay what is due to them. You pay your taxes. Now, so, you know, tax to whom taxes due, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor, so forth. We are obligated to them. Who else are we obligated to? Well, here's the segue. So in verse 7, owe nothing to anyone. It's not just the civil governments that we have obligations to. We have obligations to society as a whole, to our fellow man. We're members of this human family. And so, not only do we pay what we owe to the government, we ought to pay what we owe to our fellow man. We ought to pay our debts. You know, that's That's a basic fundamental principle, isn't it? You find it over and over again in the book of Proverbs. Pay our debts. Don't owe things to people. But then the segue goes further. Here's the transition. He says, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. I just find that to be the most interesting thing that Paul does here, to bring this around, to talk about the urgency of loving your neighbor. It's not just love your neighbor. I want you to notice there's an urgency in this. And that as Christians, we pay our debts. As Christians, we fulfill our obligations. This is our duty as Christians. This, in fact, is our duty as citizens, isn't it? So what we do as members of society. But here's his point. He says there's one debt that we must pay every day and yet go on owing every day. We never get it paid off. And what is it? It's the debt, it's the obligation to love our fellow man, to love our neighbor, to love one another. I suppose, you know, I could just sidetrack here for just a moment and say I suppose that probably right now in our country, the way things are, there's more urgency for us to look at this as there's ever been. But it's always been that way. Origen put it this way in the third century. He said, concerning this statement, that the debt of love is a debt we discharge every day and yet forever owe. So that, in other words, we never get that credit card paid off. We always are obligated to love our neighbor. So fulfilling our obligation to love our neighbor, Paul goes on to say, will cause us to keep all of the commandments. You remember that in the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, go back to Exodus chapter 20, we all remember that it's pretty obvious when you look at them that the first four of those Ten Commandments pertain to God, our relationship to God. The rest of them, 5 through 10, have to do with our relationship to our fellow man. It is not surprising then that when the man comes to Jesus over there in Matthew chapter 22 and says, what's the greatest commandment? What's the greatest commandment? What does Jesus say? He says, well, the greatest commandment is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. That's the greatest commandment. Then he says, the second like unto it is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Here you have it. The law said there are these two fundamental obligations that we have. We're obligated to God and we're obligated to our fellow man. So what do we do? What's the answer to both of those? It's the same. It's love. If we love God, then all the rest is going to fall into place. And then if we love our fellow man, then all the rest of the commandments are going to fall into place. And you know the four that Paul mentions here, he talks about adultery and murder and stealing and coveting, and then he just says, if there's any other commandment, he just says, etc. What does he say? He says they're all summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's the key to all of them. And I wonder sometimes why folks don't get that. You know, that's one of those things that we say on the one hand it is so simple, and on the other hand it is so absolutely profound, that if we could just figure that out as human beings. But I'm going to tell you there's an urgency in that. You know, he talks about this, adultery, just to use these examples he gives, you know, it's a selfish act. It's based on lust, not love. Real love respects others and exercises restraint. Murder. Love never seeks to destroy, but to build up. Love is kind, however, and always seeks the good of others. Take stealing, theft. Love is concerned with giving instead of getting. Love will respect the property and the rights of others. On and on you go. And we ought to understand that. We do understand that, I think, intellectually, but we don't always understand it in truth. We fall short often in practicing it, and when I say we, then I mean me. And yet, that should be an urgent matter to us. That when we fulfill our obligations to love our neighbor, we fulfill God's laws about treatment of others in society. But then in the second place, the Apostle Paul talks about the urgency of walking in the light. Walking, in fact, as he says, walking as in the day. So he says, do this knowing the time, that it's already the hour for you to awaken from sleep, for now salvation is nearer to us than when we believe. He illustrates it as like the passing of the night and the dawning of the day. And so when we wake up, what he means is we're to wake up from indifference. We are to wake up from lethargy. You think about when you're asleep, you don't care too much about stuff, do you? It's kind of a nice time to be asleep, not to be worried, not to be, except when you're having bad dreams about upcoming tests. It's usually pretty stress-free situation. It's nice. But he says when you wake up, it's now that it's day, we are to change things. We are to dress, first of all, as befits someone who is to face the day. I don't know what's happened in our society. Kathy and I went to Olive Garden the other night. You know, you expect Olive Garden to be a pretty nice place, and you go in there, and here's a guy sitting over there just a little ways from us wearing pajamas. What is it about people that wear pajamas anywhere, even to a nice restaurant? I don't get it. But it came to my mind, it wasn't part of my lesson. I didn't put pajamas in my outline here, in case you're wondering. But you think about this illustration. He says the night is almost gone, the day is near, so what do you need to do? You need to change your clothes. But he means in a spiritual sense. He says, let us lay aside the deeds of darkness and let's put on the armor of light. That is, we dress as befits someone who's ready to face the day. We put aside the night attire and we get ready for work. So he says, the negative, you lay aside the deeds of darkness. What does darkness signify? It signifies sin, ignorance. And we've already learned in our review of Romans here that when we are baptized into Christ, we are raised to walk in newness of life. That is, we crucify the old man of sin, put him to death. We lay aside the deeds of darkness. And so this is just another application of that principle to say is when we really recognize that we're living in these last times and we see it since the urgency of it, then we need to be reminded that we're to lay these things aside. We're to put on the armor of light. Those who have been enlightened by the gospel must clothe themselves in that gospel message. Let it be their armor, Ephesians 6 that we read this morning in our Bible class. You put it on. You don that apparel. You put on the panoply of God. That is the full armor. The full armor. That's one reason, Ross, I wanted to be sure I read all 8 verses of it. I wanted to get the whole panoply, all the armor there, not a part of it. And then it's time to examine ourselves. Socrates famously said that the unexamined life is not worth living. It's not. And if the scriptures tell us to do anything, it tells us we need to stop and examine ourselves from time to time. This passage is very much about that because he says in the 13th verse, let us behave properly. We need to examine our behavior. We need to examine our conduct. And behave as in the day. That is, we think about this fact that we are in these last times and we're still in this time of darkness, but the light is coming. The perfect, pure light of being in the presence of God. We're surrounded by sin. Are we to participate in it? What he's saying is we're to strive mightily not to behave in all of these sinful things that are part of this world, the things of the flesh, but to live in a way that befits those whose citizenship is in heaven. Because that's who we are. And if we're preparing to go there, then we need to be living as if we're preparing to go there. Behave properly. You know, there's a way of life that's fitting, a way of living that is fitting, that's appropriate. This is clearly the idea in Ephesians 5. If I could read a few verses here, with you, when the Apostle Paul comes to this idea to be imitators of God as beloved children. We're children of God, so we imitate our Father. How do we do that? Well, we do what Christ did, he says in verse 2. And then he says, more specifically, let immorality or impurity or greed not even be named among you as is proper among saints. And there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather give thanks. What I want us to notice here is not the specific details that he describes here, but the reason for it, the basis for it. The premise is that there are certain things that are fitting and appropriate for children of God, and there are certain things that are totally not fitting. So how does that apply to our text here in Romans chapter 13? He says, let us behave properly as in the day. The day is coming. We don't know when it is, but it's coming. And we want to be there with the Lord. How should we live now? Behave properly as in the day. Things that are exposed to light in contrast with the night, when deeds are supposedly hidden. And it's in that vein, it's always well to remember that God sees all at all times. He knows all. There is no creature hidden from His sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of Him with whom we have to do. Then he says in the 14th verse, it's time to put on the Lord Jesus Christ. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. Now, let me ask you this question, class. Is he telling these people to put on Christ in baptism? You don't have to answer that, but I'm asking you to think. He is writing to Christians. He is writing to people that he's already spoken to about, that the fact that they were buried with Christ in baptism, and then what? Raised to walk in the newness of life. And we had that long passage we looked at and had a lesson about living out your baptism. What he's saying to the Christians here is, put on the Lord Jesus Christ in the sense that you are baptized people. You made the good confession. You committed yourself to follow Jesus Christ. Now I say, you need to live it. It's urgent. Put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Let that be the guiding principle in your life. Just as we put on Christ when we're baptized, Galatians 3:27, Paul puts it that way. When all of us who were baptized into Christ did put on Christ, you clothed yourselves in Christ. What Paul's talking about here are the implications of that. The implications of it. Live consistently with your baptism. Partake of Christ's wholesome spirit and let Him be seen in our life. As Paul says, be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. And then he says, in connection with that, we are not to make any provision for the flesh in regards to its lust. What does it mean to make provision for the flesh? Is he talking about here having plenty of food to eat and clothes to wear, providing for the flesh, providing for the body? Not in this context. He's talking about the flesh versus the spirit. He's talking about sinful things, the fleshly life that's part of this world in which we live. And he said, don't make any provision for that. Provision means forethought. And what that means is, listen, this is a practical lesson. We need to be careful and be honest with ourselves that we no longer are going to plan our associations and where we go and what we wear, etc., etc., in order somehow to fulfill our fleshly lusts. And sometimes, if we're not careful, we can play those games. We want to be at a certain place at a certain time because we know that something might be going on there that we want to participate in. Well, if it's not something we want to participate in, then don't make any provision for it. In fact, make provisions to put that guard around yourself, to abstain from every form, every appearance of evil. Phillips puts it like this, let us be Christ's men from head to foot and give no chances to the flesh to have its fling. This is really good advice for all of us, particularly young people, but for all of us, is that we make sure that we are living in such a way, circumspectly, so as to guard ourselves and remove many of the temptations that will come upon us. Finally, we talk about a sense of urgency. This text, through and through, is talking about the nearness of salvation, isn't it? The urgency that's associated with our salvation, that's certainly urgent. It's urgent. Because he says salvation is nearer to us than when we first believed. Let me just make two applications of this principle of the urgency of salvation. The first application is what Jesus is talking about in John chapter 4, about how the fields are white unto harvest. And interesting, the setting there for this, what has happened is that we have this long account of conversation that Jesus had with a woman, a Samaritan woman, by this well. And Jesus used the opportunity of being there at this place, at this time, with this particular person, the occasion of being thirsty and wanting water, he used that opportunity to direct her thoughts to spiritual things and to her relationship with God. It's one of the great passages, one of the great examples of what it means to be a sower of the seed. Well, once that happens, then she goes into town to tell everybody about what's just happened to her, what she's learned, the person she's met. She's excited about this. And, you know, you read about how she goes in there and she says, come see a man who told me all the things I have done. This is not the Christ, is it? And so now they're all coming out. They're wanting to find out about this teacher, this man that this woman has talked about. I mean, a woman that clearly has been impacted, been changed by this. Well, the disciples, as usual, they're concerned about lunch about this time. Stomachs are growling. And they say, Rabbi, it's time to eat. And he said, I have food to eat that you do not know about. So the disciples were saying to one another, no one brought him anything to eat, did he? Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say, there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields that they are white for harvest. And you can almost see Jesus waving his hand over all these people that are coming out of town, coming out to see what this woman has learned, coming to meet Jesus. And Jesus is trying to teach the disciples something. People, these disciples that are concerned about what they're going to eat, he says, look at the fields. I think he must have been pointing to these people, I don't know. But what an occasion this was. To say that there's this opportunity, there's work to be done. And it just says to us that we talk about urgent things. This is an urgent thing, that the gospel should be our urgent plea to a lost and dying world. The work of the Lord is urgent. The work of sowing the seed is urgent. The work of sowing the seed so that the Lord may grant a harvest of soul, this is urgent. The fields are white unto harvest. Jesus said in Luke chapter 10, verse 2, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. This is urgent. And it speaks to us. And we need to have that sense of the urgency of the work of the gospel in these last days. But the other application of the nearness of salvation is, of course, the sense of urgency in responding to the gospel of salvation. And with this, I think about that parable of the wise and foolish virgins in Matthew 25, these 10 virgin girls that took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. This is a festive occasion, important occasion. And you know, 5 were prepared with extra oil to make it through the night. 5 foolishly did not bring enough. What was the turning point here is no one knew exactly what time he was going to come. Right? Nobody knew what time. So what do you need to do? Well, you're just going to hope that he'll come soon enough that we'll have enough oil to make it? Or do you take enough oil so that whenever he comes, whether he comes soon or whether he delays, we will be ready? It's a great story, one we remember, about the importance of being prepared. And so Jesus concludes by saying, be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. And so that reminds us of the importance of being ready to meet the Lord. Are you ready to meet the Lord? Am I ready to meet the Lord? When Paul was making his appeal to the brethren in Corinth, you know, he said, now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. There's no better time than now. There's no better day than today. There's no better moment than this moment that we're in now. And the reality is, the urgency of it is, that we don't know if we'll have a tomorrow. You know, the Lord may come before tomorrow. And even if He delays, my life might end before tomorrow. We may run out of opportunities. And so the gospel call is to all of us, is to say to be sure that we have prepared ourselves for the coming of the Lord. That's an appointment that will take place. He will come, and we will stand before Him. And I want to be there ready to go to heaven. I want to be prepared. That's urgent. If we can help you in your response to the gospel today in any way, please come and make your wish known to us while we stand and sing.